Hey, everybody, how's it going? My guest this week is Burt Ward. Yes, Robin from the original Batman and Robin series. How cool is this? Really great guy. Cool conversation about how he got the part, what it was like working on the series, and I did it in tights, just in his honor. All right, it wasn't in his honor. I do a lot of things in tights now, and we'll get into that on another episode. Real quick, my one-man show, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio, which has been on Broadway, is extending its run, and we're moving venues September 12th. We're going to now be at the Actors Temple Theater on 47th Street and 8th Avenue in Manhattan. Really psyched. It's been going really well. Great feedback, getting great stories. Go to Telecharge for tickets. Use the code PMFAN, and you get 50% off. That's half price because I like the cut of your jib. It's a really cool show. I'm really proud of it. People coming in, out, audiences come on stage, tell stories, just talk about their lives. Everybody has a story. Talk to this Muslim guy. He's married to this Jewish woman. I said, you're going to raise your kids Jewish or Muslim? He goes, they go, Jewish, of course. And I'm like, why, of course? They go, because we want to get scholarships. There are Jewish scholarships. There are no Muslim scholarships, he goes. So there you go. You see it from his perspective. Anyway, we're getting really cool stories, and I'd love you to come and be part of it and check it out. Go to Telecharge. Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio. PM Fan is the code. And we'll come. You have some laughs. We'll hang out. Come backstage. You'll see my monkey. I have a monkey now because I'm trying to become like a pseudo celebrity who's a little bizarre. So I figure, let me go with a monkey. I was going to do a Shetland pony, but they shit a lot. Yeah, you'd be surprised. Anyway, enjoy Burt Ward. Very happy to have you here with us this week, and very special guest, someone that I've known since I was about a little boy, although he didn't know me, from watching him on TV and over the years as Robin in the famous and great Batman and Robin television series, and also founder of Gentle Giants Rescue, which has been saving dogs' lives and helping them to live twice as long, which is an amazing story. It's actor Burt Ward. Burt, welcome to the show.
Hello, citizen.
I love it. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Pow, zap, pow. how is it that you? I want to talk about Batman and Robin, but you have this great story behind this rescue that you established with your wife. My wife and I, we've adopted two rescue dogs from Bidawi in New York City, where we live, and we're on our second one now, Daisy. They've been great, and this is something that's near and dear to our heart. And how did that sort of come about, that this all, because I know you had a Great Dane and fell in love with your Great Dane, and it led you to see that there were a lot of especially large dogs that were basically not being paid attention to or cared for. Is that right?
Well, I'll explain to you. About 24 years ago, when my wife and I moved to where we are, we decided for our young daughter to get her a dog, and we wanted a Great Dane, and we rescued one, and then we rescued a second one, and later on, we found out that the ones that we didn't rescue ended up being put to death in animal shelters, and we thought, what a horrible thing when these dogs are gentle giants, and we decided that we were going to start rescuing Great Danes. We thought we'd just do it for a couple of weeks till we found somebody else to take over, but it's been 24 years and 15,500 dogs that we've rescued. By the way, every one would have been put to death if we hadn't been there to save their lives and to properly feed them and care for them and provide all medical and give each one a safe, loving home that we were able to find. So in the course of saving all these animals, we developed a feeding and care program to help dogs live longer, because Great Danes traditionally only live 7 to 9 years, and we actually rescued 45 different breeds of dogs. Now, when you consider that there's only 164 breeds of dogs, for us to rescue 45 is about one-third of all the breeds of dogs. And dogs traditionally don't live very long. Well, most dogs live on an average of 7 to 10 years. And we've got them living now to 27 years, okay? And we've got, in fact, right now, 24 of the dogs here at our rescue have already lived more than twice their normal lifespan. But you can't do that by feeding regular dog food. and you have to learn how to properly feed and care for them. So we developed this program, and it's a charity. Our rescue is a 501c3 charity, no different than Muscular Dystrophy or United Way. We don't take any salary whatsoever from either our dog food or from our rescue. Again, this is all about loving animals. But we also developed this Gentle Giant dog food, and our food is different from every other dog food. People say, well, how can it be so different? Well, it's all natural without the grease that you feel on the outside of dog food. Dog food has a greasy feeling, and the reason it's on the outside is because manufacturers spray it on there, animal fat, to get dogs to eat more so that you'll feed your dog more and so that you'll ultimately buy more of their dog food. Well, that takes a toll on the dog's body. Just like you wouldn't pour bacon grease down your garbage disposal at home because it would ruin a metal garbage disposal. So why would anybody who loves their dog feed them a food that every single kibble is encapsulated in animal fat?
Yeah.
We don't do that. So that plus the way we feed and care for the dogs, we have our website, gentlegiantsdogfood.com. It explains in great detail how to properly feed and care for your dog. It talks about our food. It explains how we have dogs living up to 27 years. And you know, people say to me, well, Bert, if you could get a dog to live 27 years, that dog probably couldn't even walk. And I say, oh, no, that's not the case at all. Our dogs are still running around like puppies in their 20s.
Mm.
And you, again, anybody can have it. And you know, people say to me, but I love my dog so much, you know, and I ask people, how long would you like your dog to live? And guess what, Paul? Everybody says the same thing, forever.
Right.
They can't live forever, but they can now live 2 and 3 times longer, and not just living longer, but living healthier, and their quality of life. Our dogs in their 20s are... I've got one of them, my Russian Wolfhound Tara. She's 27 years old. Her lifespan traditionally is only 7 to 9 years. She's lived more than triple her lifespan, and she still jumps in the air.
Wow.
So, you know, it's all about how you properly care and feed for animals and for people who love their dogs. I mean, my gosh, wouldn't you want your dog to live 2 or 3 times longer? And in fact, our dogs are so healthy here because of our Gentle Giants dog food, that the only time we take them to our vet is every 3 years for a $10 rabies update.
3 years? My wife takes our dog like every 8 or 9 months. I mean, the dog's healthy, but that's all the dog needs is every 3 years, really? That's amazing.
Well, we do give some shots on our own, but rabies shots are required to be given by a veterinarian.
Right.
So I think an annual checkup is still good. But the point that I'm making is our dogs aren't sick.
Right.
Our dogs are healthy.
Right.
And they're living incredibly long, active lives. And you know, when people, they feed our Gentle Giants dog food, and they'll call me a month later and say, I think I have a completely different dog.
Yeah.
This dog is healthier than I've ever seen. The coat is better. The dog is happier. And you know, dogs that are overweight will lose weight on our food. Dogs that are underweight will gain weight. In other words, they end up being perfectly wonderful and healthy. And again, all of this is for charity. And by the way, I told you, we don't take any salary from this. So our Gentle Giants dog food, okay, which we have in all the Walmarts in America, it actually retails for half the price of what you would pay for a dog food in a pet store. Can you imagine? Less than half the price. We have a big 33-pound bag for $34. It's unheard of. And our motto is half the price and twice the life.
There you go. And do you find that why are there so many, just generally in your experience, like why are there so many abandoned dogs or dogs that need adoption in this country? I mean, is it general?
Overbreeding is the answer, Paul.
Right.
Okay, that's the problem. That there are puppy mills that breed puppies after puppies after puppies, and they don't always have a home for those puppies. You know.
Right.
And then the sad thing is, you know, and there's people that are what we call backyard breeders that get a male and a female. They don't spay or neuter them. And by the way, spaying and neutering is incredibly important.
Yes.
And the reason for that is because cancer is still the number one killer of all dogs in America, cancer. Okay? But what most people don't realize is that 85% of all cancer in dogs originates in the reproductive organs. So by an early spay or neuter, you can add 2 or 3 years to your dog's life just by doing that.
Unbelievable. And this has really become a passion for you. Obviously, you know, you sort of made your name as an actor, and, you know, you were 19 when you were chosen for the role out of, I think it was 1,100 people.
Actually,
going
20. I was 20 going on 21.
There you go.
I had to go to court to have my contract approved. But yes, it was, you know, and Batman, of course, my gosh, what an amazing experience that was.
And you still have the enthusiasm. It's funny, just talking to you, I feel like I'm talking to Burt Ward from Batman. And when you were 20, you have a level of enthusiasm that's incredible. And I assume you've always been like this, and this is who you are.
Paul, you hit it on the head. That's why I was chosen. You know, there was 1,100 young actors that were interviewed for the part of Robin.
Mm-hmm.
1,100.
Unbelievable.
I mean, talk about competition. And the executive producer, William Dozier, he came to me and he said, "Bert, we want to select you. Would you like to know why?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Because if there really was a Robin, forget television for a minute, but if there really was a Robin, we think that you personally would be it. So we don't want you to, quote, act. We want you to just be yourself and be enthusiastic, which is what I did for 120 episodes. So many people say to me, "Oh my gosh, you sound like yourself. Oh my gosh, you have the energy of Robin." Well, yes, because the character was me.
But you had this, you have this amazing story. You were, you could read, was it 30,000 words a minute? You were also very, very smart, and you were thinking of going to medical school. Talk about your background, because you were, also, you were a brown belt martial artist when you got the role, and that was one of the other reasons, but very highly accomplished at a young age. And talk about your background a little bit at that age and what you were doing and had accomplished.
Well, my father believed in an early work ethic. So I started to work professionally when I was 2 years old. My father had a traveling ice show called Rhapsody on Ice. It was the predecessor to the Ice Capade. And at 2 years of age, I skated in the show. And they would introduce me. And, you know, it's so strange. A lot of things, you know, you can't remember as the years go by. But
right.
I remember my little skate. And I remember this big arena that I was in where you could hear the people because of the bright lights. I couldn't see anybody. But I would have two of the skaters that would skate me around the arena there. And people would cheer, and then they'd let me go, and I skated by myself, and people just went nuts. How could a two-year-old skate by themselves, you know? And I was in every show. And from there on, throughout my life, I studied very hard. I was a very good student. I was straight A at UCLA. I was placed in the top 3% of the country in math and science. When I left UCLA to do Batman, my dean at the university was upset. She said I should have been a nuclear physicist. You know?
So, yeah, but you can't wear tights when you're a nuclear physicist, and you look good in tights.
Yeah,
let's be honest.
That I'm not thrilled about. Believe me, don't get me started on those tights. They were I called them my tights on pants because they nearly strangled me.
Did you ever say anything about the? About the outfit, and did you have any input or any of that, or you were just paid for hire?
No, they did try to help me because it was really uncomfortable. The cape was double thick bridal satin, so when the cape would pull back on the neck, we figured out all kinds of things to make it easier to wear. But that was a challenge. But doing the show, of course, was amazing. I mean, who wouldn't want to be riding in the Batmobile, you know, fighting villains alongside Batman, climbing walls?
Right.
You know.
So the innocence of Robin, was that something that was already written into the script, or is that something that you brought to it? Like, what? Obviously, you said your personality was one of the big reasons you got it, but like. What were you allowed to bring to the role of Robin in addition to what they had already kind of scripted in their minds?
Pretty much everything, Paul, pretty much everything. And I'll tell you why. On Batman, there were so many effects, really complicated, you know, that involved explosions or breakaway buildings or all these fight scenes, that the producers were so occupied and the crew with getting all these effects to work that basically they allowed Adam and I, as long as we said our lines and we were in the right location, to do what we wanted.
Wow.
In other words, so for example, you know, when you would see in the Batmobile, sometimes I would jump over the door to get in or out of the Batmobile.
Right.
Sometimes I would stand up and walk along the fin of the back of the Batmobile, much to the chagrin of the George Barris who built the Batmobile. And I understand these people were having near heart attacks and I'm walking on their beautiful Batmobile with my bat boots. But, you know, we were allowed to do, and, you know, Adam and I had a very special chemistry. You know, the great comic duos in history have always had great contrasts, you know, like Laurel and Hardy, or Abbott and Costello, or Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon. Mm. They had great contrasts, and, you know, Adam was just an amazing guy to work with. We became best friends, and
you were at his funeral in June when he passed away.
They didn't have a funeral mm-hmm. because he was cremated. But the point of it was we were very, very close, and for all these years after we finished the filming, we still did two animated features together, and we made a personal appearances together.
Right.
We would go out, and I would see him just about every weekend or every other weekend all across America at these big events, and we hold arena records at various giant auditoriums and stuff. And some of my last appearances with him, one of them was in Dallas, 80,000 paid attendance to 80,000 people.
Have you been going to Comic-Con? I'm sure that, yeah.
The Comic-Cons I'm referring to.
Yeah.
And in Toronto, 160,000 attendance at that Comic-Con to see us. And there were other celebrities there too, but the lines were incredibly long to see us.
Explain to me what your thoughts are on why people, I mean, these are adults that go to these things for the most part. What is the obsession? I mean, you're on the receiving end. You must be a huge attraction at these Comic-Cons. What is it about that world of the comic book world and series and stars like yourself that are such a draw to adults who very often are very, very smart people too, maybe a little on the nerdy side, but very, very smart. Is it an escape for them? What is it?
Well, it's different things for different folks, actually. What it is mainly is that, you know, the characters we portrayed were bigger than life. I mean, look, you've got all these superhero movies out now that are so popular. Why are they so popular? Because the things that superheroes can do are bigger in life than what regular humans can do.
Right.
And
So
there's an attraction to be able to do these spectacular things. So for the kids, it's the hero worship. But these kids that watch Batman as they grew up in their homes, I mean, we were in their homes twice a week, in their living rooms, okay? They grew up and watching Batman, and there's a fondness they have. I mean, for example, when I make a personal appearance, people come up, and let's say it's a mom, dad, and the two kids or something like that. Well, what's so interesting is that when I actually meet them for a few moments, maybe even a couple of minutes, for the mother and father, they become childlike.
Wow.
In other words, they start talking like they were when they were kids. Like the father might say to me something like, oh, you know, when I was young, my brother played Batman, but I played Robin, and we used to have our bath towels with clothespins pinned around our neck to hold onto our capes, and we jumped off the couch. And people are looking at him saying, Dad? And then the mother will say something like, oh, and I was in love with Rob. Mom, what are you talking like that for? I mean, and that is incredibly entertaining.
Yeah.
And of course, then they become the adult again, and, you know, but because their kids have never seen them as children. okay?
Right.
As adults. So for me, it's amazingly entertaining, but it kind of explains. And people like this whole thing with, you know, all these super characters and daring dudes. And, you know, why are the movies so popular? For the same reason.
How long would it take you to sort of, you know, it's funny because I was watching it's on MeTV, and I was watching Batman and Robin about a week ago one night, and I was watching this one particular scene that you all were fighting. I think Eartha Kitt, by the way, you worked some amazing actors too. Cesar Romero, Eartha Kitt, like what, you must have learned.
Price was Egghead, Joan Collins was the Siren,
yeah.
Frank Gorshin was the Riddler, Burgess Meredith was the Penguin. Oh, I mean, some of the great, great actors and actresses of all time.
What a great opportunity for you as a young actor. What did you learn? Must have been an incredible 3 years. Like, what were some of the bigger things you learned about acting in that process, with acting with some of those people?
What I learned, that one of the things that carried with me was the fact that these professionals took their craft, and I mean it, craft is the right word, because they were true artists. You know, there's artists can paint things, and there's people that can sing, but these were artists that were incredibly professional. They came in, they knew their lines. They had a professionalism that and was just amazing, and the talent was just, you know, I mean, just bubbling out of them. They're just such naturals. And so for me, to see people that their craft, their work means so much to them that they would put their heart in it so 100%. It was just like, wow.
Would they help you technically? Would they help you technically in terms of sort of like, you know, in a scene when you were working with them, with Burgess or anybody that you were working with, would they sort of try to sort of, if you needed it, I'm not assuming saying you did,
no,
but
no, 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 no. You see, because remember, I was selected because the producers wanted me to just be myself.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Which is really not too hard to do.
Yeah.
The fact that, you know, I have these two animated features, one that came out a year ago, one came out 6 months ago, animated called Batman vs. Two-Face, the most recent one. Adam West did the voice of Batman. I did the voice of Robin. And then the voice of Two-Face was portrayed by none other than William Shatner, you know. And people say to me, oh, well, what did you have to do to get ready to do this? Did you have to retrain? Did you have? And I said, no, I didn't do anything.
He just woke up and took a shower.
and people, you know, I talk to them. They say, oh my gosh, Bert, you sound like yourself, and you know, and all of this kind of stuff.
But there's an innocence. There's an innocence and a purity to you and talking to you that is obviously what Robin is and was. And I guess that was sort of subconsciously what the creators saw in Robin, and therefore you found it for them, right? I mean, like when you started this interview, you went, hello, citizens. Like, that's funny, but it's also sort of representative of like sort of who that character is and who you are. And I guess there was a feeling like the crime fighters should be these pure innocents in a way who are straight down the middle and, you know, just black and white.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, and the thing is that in my own personal life, I grew up, I never smoked. I never drank. I never took a drug. Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of people hear about actors or musicians or whatever that get involved with those kinds of negative stuff. I never did that.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, grew up in a healthy atmosphere with a good family, and you know, none of these horrible stories that you hear that many actors have. So for me, it was natural to do the right things, to eat the right food, to be healthy. And I've noticed that other actors who are my age don't look like themselves as much as I look like myself.
Now, you talked about the
health has been.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say health is very important.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
You know, and you got to take care of yourself. And if you do, you know, you can enjoy life so much better. And if you do the right things, and in our life, my wife and I, just like with our dedication to saving animals, and, you know, it's something interesting because in our lives, we reach a point where it's not so much about doing stuff for ourselves anymore. It's about doing things for others. And we actually get more enjoyment helping others than doing things for ourselves. I don't need any more toys. You know, I don't need to buy anything. At this point, I just enjoy saving animals. I enjoy helping people live a better life, because we're all on this planet, Paul, such a short period of time.
Oh, yeah.
We all should make the most of it.
Yeah.
We really care about people. I mean, there are other actors that have become successful that they want to retire on some, you know, Caribbean island or something. But no, my wife and I, we work 7 days a week, and we do a tremendous amount of charity.
Yeah.
And it's very enriching when you can make life a little bit better for people.
Oh yeah, absolutely. You had mentioned your relationship with Adam Wesson as actors. So, you know, sort of the chemistry that you had, it's funny because in watching the show, his Batman would sort of be maybe a little bit less innocent and a little bit more sarcastic at times, which worked well against your sort of innocence and sort of outrage how would you describe, you talked about the Laurel and Hardy or the, you know, that sort of that great duos over time. Like, how would you describe what your character brought to the relationship and what his did?
Well, Adam, you know, people, it's funny, because they ask me about Adam. They say, you know, Adam is so, like, you know, the character of Batman, so stoic,
yeah,
so grand, so, you know, they said, in real life, is Adam West like that? And I said, he's exactly like that. and the thing is that, so, I mean, Adam likes to think of himself like Winston Churchill.
Right, so, right.
Gigantic terms, right?
Yeah.
And he liked to, everything was very dignified and all this kind of stuff. And I was like a kid, you know? Right. I'm wild and crazy, and he's stoic, and it's such a complete opposite.
Yeah.
Yet the two of us, you know.
That's why it worked. It worked because of that.
But there's one more aspect to it, and that is this. Adam had one of the best senses of humor of anybody I've ever met in my life. And not just the sense of humor in his private life, but as an actor. In other words, what we did on Batman that I really believe made our show so incredibly successful, there was a couple things. One, we appealed to a very broad audience. For children, it was hero worship. Right? Who wouldn't want to ride in the Batmobile and climb walls and fight villains?
Right.
For the adults, it was the nostalgia of the comic book. For the teenagers and college kids, however, it was something that Adam and I developed, which was a campy style.
Yes.
It was a style of double meaning, suggestiveness, the kind of things that you could take one way or another. And it was also what we called playing with the audience. You know, at the time, if you watched a show on television that, say, was like a police show, you know, they're trying to apprehend somebody who did something wrong. Or if it was a medical show, they're trying to save a life. But in the case of Batman, we went right through the television sets, and we went right at our viewers with things that were very straight and, you know, all-American and apple pie, and yet had a kind of a, you know, am I putting you on? You know, kind of an attitude.
Yeah.
We used to say that we put on our tights to put on the world.
Yeah.
And because of that, the kids took it as straight hero worship. But college kids and high school kids at that time, they didn't want to be inside watching television. They wanted to be cruising around, you know, going out on dates and things like that. And yet, when Batman came out, it was such a huge hit that in dormitories across the country, people were there 2 hours earlier before the show aired just to get a seat in time for our show. Nobody had ever put on an audience. Nobody had ever done such suggestive double meaning, you know, where you're never really sure. No, wait, you know, are they putting me on? Are they really?
Do you remember like one example, just for listeners who maybe haven't seen? Do you remember any? And not to put you on the spot, any example of that? Because you're absolutely right. It's almost a precursor to what they do with animated movies now. These big, blockbuster size budget movies where they have to make them so that your 8-year-old kid can enjoy it, but the parent can sit through it too. But you guys were doing it in the 60s before those things even exist. And because you're right, as you say that, it's like you guys would engage in some conversation that, oh, I don't want to say risque, but like it would sort of push the boundaries. And you know, a 7-year-old kid's not getting it, but I'm sitting there laughing. Like, do you remember any examples of that?
A perfect example. You want a perfect example?
Yeah.
This one happens to be quite risque. In fact, the next week after this, the censors were in yelling at Adam and I together. That's what it was. There was a scene where we had brought Batgirl into the Batcave.
Right.
And but we couldn't let her find out the location of the Batcave because that could reveal our secret true identity.
Right.
So on the way out, there was three of us. We're in the Batmobile. Batman, of course, driving. I was in the passenger seat, and Batgirl was sitting in between us. So we had to give her this knockout gas here so that, you know, she would be asleep until we got out of the Batmobile and not be able to know where, you know, we were located or who we were. So the scene starts off with Batgirl already kind of like, you know, asleep. Mm. And we're about to start the Batmobile. And my line to Batman was, you know, Batman, Batgirl is really pretty. Okay. And Batman had a simple line like, well, you know, Robin, I'm glad that you noticed. It shows that, you know, you're growing up or something like that, right? Mm. Very plain.
Mm.
Well, Adam purposely, okay, I didn't notice it at first, but I didn't understand why. He flubbed like 12 takes. 12. Mm. Now, you got to understand, there's tremendous pressure on a movie or television set because it's so expensive. There's like 80 guys on the crew. It was, you know, I mean, there's like hundreds of thousands of dollars a day to make these shows, you know, hundreds. So for to have something that on a single shot to delay you could cost the studio a huge amount of money. Anyway, he messed up these first 12 takes. And I knew Adam wasn't the first kind of person to mess things up.
Mm-hmm.
I knew there was some reason why he was messing them up, but I didn't know why. Okay? And what happens is it reaches a point where the director says, hey, we're going to have to use the next take no matter what. You know what I mean? We got to move on.
Okay,
so he would wait till the last one. He knew it. He knew how, well, the way I described it, stretching the elastic, how far you could do it before it popped. So what happened was, is that, this was like now the, I think it was the 14th take, okay? And here's what happened. You know, here we are, action, and I said, gosh, Batman, you know, Batgirl is really very pretty. And he says, I'm glad you noticed that, Robin. It shows the oncoming thrust of manhood.
That's great.
Now, there you are.
That's
something that had went way over the kid's head.
Yeah.
But, like, I had tears. I had to keep a straight face. It surprised me. I didn't know he was going to. I didn't know that. You know what I mean? I had tears coming down the sides of my mask.
Oh, God.
You know what I mean? I just contained myself. I couldn't ruin the tape. And guess what? The director, nobody noticed.
Because they're all, they're all like, we got to move on. Next scene, right?
But, next week. The censors came in. Everybody noticed it.
Oh, that's true.
And said, gee, I'm sorry. You know, I didn't get my line right intentionally. And it was that kind of double meaning that we inserted throughout the entire show. And the viewers, the college kids particularly, and the high schoolers that started to watch for that, and that became the biggest thing amongst that age group of, did you see Batman? What they did. Did you see what they really tried? Stuff like that. Now, by today's standards, it's quite tame, but it wasn't tame then.
Yeah. I mean, it was a very stylized show, too. And there's sort of reading up on it that the show lasted 3 years. The ratings were high, but it was a very expensive show to produce. And that had something to do with it not continuing. And what.
Yes, they were losing. I think $100,000 or $200,000 a week.
Jeez!
Once they had made the 120 episodes, they had enough to then you know, sell it into reruns, which, although it didn't make as much money, there was no cost because it was already made. So they were able to get the money back that they had lost and make a profit. And it became a dollars and cents, you know, that's what it became.
But why not figure out a way to do it less expensively and keep it going? Because it's such a following at that point. Was there any
conversation? Yeah. You tried, you couldn't do it. You know, in some of these things, you either do it right or you don't do it at all.
Yeah.
You can't skimp on this. And they actually tried that the third season, and that's one of the reasons why it went off the air, because, you know, we had somebody that was directing it that brought it in on budget every time, but it lost the charm. It lost the spontaneity. It lost the humor.
Yeah. And did you, you know, you mentioned sort of, we talked initially about your martial arts prowess. I think you had to break a board as part of your audition, right? And
right.
But then you also went on to Bruce Lee lived in your condo complex, and
used to spar together. In fact, a piece of trivia for your listeners is that Bruce Lee's first filmed fight scene of his career was fighting me. And, you know, he went on to become the most famous cinema martial artist in the world.
Yeah.
You know, there's nobody that was more famous than Bruce Lee. And his very first fight scene of his career on film was fighting me.
Why was he so adept at that, at martial arts? What made him so special compared to others? I mean, you obviously very accomplished yourself, black belt, which you got from the
right.
All-Korean champion.
In fact, 2 years ago, I was inducted into the International Karate and Kickboxing Hall of Fame. So that was a very nice honor. But what the difference is that, first of all, Bruce was an amazing talent.
Hmm.
You know, there are some people that, you know, they have to struggle to do certain things and they can become proficient at it. But, you know, it's not natural to them. For him, martial arts was just so natural. And he trained 8 hours a day, every single day.
Mm.
8 hours of training a day.
Mm.
And he learned all these different styles. He would, in his life growing up, he would go and challenge people and get into terrible fights, you know, and sometimes he was greatly injured, but he learned their styles. So he just was like a sponge absorbing all these different styles. And then he created his own style of martial arts by combining the best of all these various elements.
Mm-hmm. And you had, did you learn, you must have learned something from him? I mean, what, in terms of my...
I learned something from him, but he, you know, we sparred at it, and it wasn't one-sided. I mean, he got hit.
Yeah.
You know? and it was for me, it was a great experience, but we were also friends. I mean, we would go down to Chinatown. At this time in his life, his wife, Linda, and they had their son, Brandon, was 6 months of age.
Mm.
And we would go down into Chinatown, and because he had lived in Hong Kong for 10 years, he knew all the most authentic Chinese food to order and stuff like that. And we were good friends, had a good relationship. And
what attracted you? Yeah, it really was just, there was a one-of-a-kind person. What was it about the martial arts that sort of drew you to it at such a young age and kept, obviously, passionate about it? But what did you get from it? I mean, beyond, obviously, physical exercise, what did it bring to you?
Well, you know, in a world that's become increasingly dangerous, you know, you want to think that you can protect yourself.
Yeah.
I guess self-preservation.
Mm.
Secondly, it was great training, but it wasn't just physical training. There's a mental training that goes with it.
Mm.
And you know, it's kind of like, you know, there are people that go into the military and they come out of the military and they say, you know, I really needed to go into the military. I needed to learn discipline.
Right.
I needed to, you know, make something of my life.
Yeah.
And it was that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, if you really study something and you really put your heart in it, you can get great results.
Yeah.
Nothing is achieved without effort.
Oh, absolutely. I say that to my son all the time. I couldn't agree more. But, you know, the other thing about this was that, if I read this correctly, you were told by the producers of Batman you had to do a lot of your own stunts, more so than Adam, because more of your face was showing under the mask. But it was really turned out to be a way for them to save money on using stunt doubles. Is that right?
And I don't think they were trying to save money because they had to pay the stuntman to be there anyway.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't saving money. The problem was they couldn't find anybody that looked like me.
What?
And my stuntman.
Really?
You know, his nose, he looked like Cyrano de Bergerac. You know, and so as a result of anything that was close, they always had to use me. And, you know, he'd be sipping coffee while I was being driven to the emergency hospital with second-degree burns or a broken nose from a 2x4 landing on my nose. I mean, it was a dangerous show to make.
So you got injured on a pretty regular basis, huh?
Well, I put it this way. In the first episode, four out of the first 6 days, I ended up going to the emergency hospital.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
I'd never even been to an emergency hospital accident prone. It's just really dangerous.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And it probably, there was no, at that time, there probably was no show like it that had been produced yet that had that level of stunts in terms of volume and sophistication either. So it was probably a learning curve.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. But I'll tell you, the studio was very smart. They took out a very big life insurance policy on me after the first week. And I can tell you something. By the end of the third year, when we were about to close down, I could swear they were trying to collect on that policy.
Let's get the most out of this guy if we try to figure it out so that they kill you off in the very last scene of the very last episode.
Yeah, literally.
That's incredible. Well, I think it's really great that you're one of the people that gives back with this charity that you're doing, and especially, you know, my wife and I particularly are big believers in rescuing animals and taking care of them. We live in New York City. We see so many, you know, there's so many strays and all of that, and I think it's tremendous that you guys have sort of dedicated your life to this kind of thing.
Well, and we encourage other people to do what they can. Not everybody can afford to spend the time that we've spent caring for animals, but they could do something.
Yeah.
You could, you know, bring an extra blanket or something that you don't need to an animal shelter so that a dog can be more comfortable instead of being on a cement surface. I mean, in other words, we all can be what my wife calls canine crusaders, superheroes,
yeah,
where we do something to help life. And you know, the way my wife and I look at this is that we've been married 29 years, incredibly happy. I'm the luckiest guy in the world. But, you know, life is the most precious commodity in the world. It really is.
Right.
And, you know, when you do things for other people, good things come back to you. Mm-hmm. People don't realize that. Some people that, you know, they save animals, wonderful things in life come to them. And they're incredibly happy. And it's not always about money. It's about being kind and making a better world for all of us, because we're all here all for such a very short period of time. We all need to make the most of every day.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, and, you know, when you say that, you sound like Robin. I don't mean that as a joke, but you sound positive and like you just – it's a great – you have a great message and a great vibe, and I think it's really admirable what you guys are doing. And how can people
and you know, with the dogs that we've rescued and the fact that we've spent 24 years of our life. I mean, can you imagine having 15,500 dogs in your house over a 24-year period?
That's right, because you keep, they're actually in your house, right?
They're in our living room. They're in our room. They're everywhere they want to go.
How many dogs at one time have you had in your house?
Oh, we always have for the last 24 years, 45 to 50, sometimes a few more.
But wait, do you have a kennel like on your property kind of thing?
No kennel. No. There's no.
You have 45 dogs in your house?
Yes.
You guys are insane.
Yes.
You're in.
If you go to our website, gentlegiantsdogfood.com, look at the video. There's one video of 27 of these giant dogs in bed with us.
Unbelievable.
There'd be more, but they couldn't get on the bed. There wasn't enough room. No, this is absolutely, you know, real. I mean, and people are stunned. They see, you mean they're really right there in your living room. They're not in some building. They're not in some garage. They live in the main living area of our home. And because they live communally together, we've created a very nurturing environment for dogs to live in. And that's part of how we feed and care for them. That's how we can have dogs living into their late 20s. When most people's dogs don't even last 10 years.
That's really incredible.
If you love your dog, my God, don't you want that dog with you? I mean, that dog, their whole life is their master.
Oh, yeah.
You know, they drive cars. They don't go to movies. They don't go to the beach. Some of them get to go if their master takes them to the beach. But, you know, dog owners are very lucky to have such dedicated animals that just want to love them.
Yeah.
You have the best day at work or the worst day at work. They love you unconditionally. And don't we owe them for the love that they give us, kindness, and to give them the best food and the best way to keep them healthy and to keep them around us? I mean, think about it. If you can have your dog an extra 5 or 10 years longer, what does it do for you in addition for what it does for the dog? And that's what we've done with our Gentle Giants dog food that's in all the Walmarts in America. That's what we've done with our feeding and care program. It's all about charity. We don't take a single dime from it.
Yeah.
A single penny.
It's incredible.
People keep saying, they say to me, you know, Bert, I guess what you do is you take the profits from your dog food and donate it to your charity. And I say, no, we didn't build any profits in it. We gave it at our cost to the stores so they could sell it so that people who don't have a lot of money could afford to get the best food in the world.
Yeah.
We've done that.
That's great.
We sacrificed them. And we don't need the money. We're not at a point in life where I need to go try to make more money. We're at a point in life where the greatest happiness we get is for saving lives, for helping people in this world be happy. And I devote all of my time to charity.
Yeah.
All of my time, except for the stuff that I'm doing with our movies and the things with Warner Brothers. I have a lot of projects in the works that I'm doing. Those are fun things to do, but they also bring people happiness because you entertain them.
Yeah.
So really, my entire life is about making a better world for all of us.
Yeah, well, it's great, and I encourage you to keep up the work, great work. And tell people where they can go to learn more about what you're doing, both, you know, with the charity and, you know, you're on the professional side with Batman and everything. And, you know,
everything is on there, even though it's gentlegiantsdogfood.com. It's got all the Batman stuff on it too.
All right, great.
It's got videos and interviews and wonderful things like the interview we're doing together where people can, I mean, you can spend days seeing the videos of the dogs or watching the interviews, watching some of the action on Batman. It's all there. It's all one thing because it's all part of my life.
Okay. Well, please go check out the site and keep an eye out for other projects coming from the great Burt Ward, Boy Wonder. And I can't thank you enough for being on the show. It's really, really great to talk to you. You have a really rich and full life and very interesting guy. And I was really happy we could have a few minutes to talk and get to know you a little bit better.
Well, I've enjoyed it too, Paul. And thank you for the opportunity. And wowie zowie, the Batmobile.
There you go. That's exactly what I wanted to hear. Thank you, Burt Ward. You're the best. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care. Thank you, Paul.
All right, that was Burt Ward. How great is that guy, huh? Cool. Really interesting background. Some cool insight into what it's like to work on that show. And I hope you guys can come and check my one-man show out on Broadway, Permission to Speak with Paul Mercurio. It's September 12th, starting up again at a new venue, the Actors Temple Theater. Go to Telecharge for tickets and use the code PMFAN. You get 50% off. And I hope you guys can make it out. And we'll see you next week, everybody.